Hi everyone, thanks for tuning in here. We're going to kick this thing off. Welcome back from your break. And we're going to kick it off with some CSS work here. We're going to do a presentation called Looks Over Logic, presented by yours truly here, David West. So let's jump into the slide deck here and get you guys on my screen here. So let's kick this off. So I like to call this presentation Looks Over Logic, because I like the idea of that developers do a lot of work with logic and making high functionality code and everything like that. And we want to turn those kind of logistical sorts of people into designers and by leveraging things like CSS compilers and frameworks. But before I want to kind of warm up with an introduction, so that's me, I'm David West. I work at the University of Manitoba, the Faculty of Medicine, as a systems analyst. When I'm not doing my 9-to-5 there and solving their problems with software, I'm focusing on my passion, that is video games. Not necessarily just playing them though, but actually getting involved in building applications around video games, such as restoring zanyvideogamequotes.com, and you can check that one out if you want, or building my own games, where I'm actually a producer on this one, an HTML5 video game called from Brewpub Games called Love Bucket. The theme that I have across all of my side interests, whether they be at the U of M or outside of work, the fact that I'm an MVP because I do a lot of HTML5 work. That focuses around the idea that I'm an Internet Explorer MVP. Now, an Internet Explorer MVP, at the end of the day, does what I just said. A lot of HTML5 work. It's not like I sit there loving nothing but HTML5 specific or Internet Explorer specifically, but rather I focus on the open standards platform. Now, what I find very fascinating about HTML5 is the fact that I can leverage this code across not just web applications, but inside of Windows Store applications as well. So again, another very powerful set of features there. And today, though, when we're talking HTML5, we're going to be talking about one specific set, that being CSS3. What you're looking at here is the CSS3 logo. That's considered one of the 8 different technology platforms inside of the HTML5 group of specifications that makes it up. And we're going to be focusing in on some specific details on how we can best leverage CSS3 inside of our store apps and our HTML apps. So our goals for today, we want to learn about frameworks and or compilers. So more specifically, some of the new features, how we can use them, and just ultimately what they are, how we can use frameworks and compilers to do better, to make better apps. And one of the key reasons I've done this presentation now is I have a lot of conversations with developers regarding design, and they realize that although CSS is very important, they don't necessarily think that's part of their job. And one of the reasons they say that is that, you know, they're not a designer. And there's this kind of almost this fear that goes with design when it comes to applications. And I want this presentation to help remove some of that fear from the developer world. I'm not saying we're going to make everyone a graphic designer by the end of this presentation, but rather have the tools to bring your application to what I would call 60 or 70%. So that it looks and feels how you want it to feel, and then you bring your graphic designer in later on. So our agenda for today is, we did our introductions now. We're going to warm up the CSS a bit, kind of understand what it can do, just kind of get us all on the same page. And then we're going to dive into the meat, and we're going to talk about the frameworks and the compilers themselves. So when we're warming up the CSS, I want to try to answer 3 questions. 1, what is CSS? 2, what can it do? And 3, why you should care as a developer. So what is CSS? Well, CSS means, in the literal sense, cascading style sheets. It's an acronym for cascading style sheets. It's considered part of the HTML5 collection of specs, as we were talking about before. And it's a series of rules. At the end of the day, it's a series of rules that applies to your DOM elements inside of your HTML. So it applies formatting and styling to your HTML code. So it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Windows Store, whether you're talking about a pure web app, that's really what CSS does. It's just you define your logic. So what can it do? Well, it can do all kinds of things. But one of the big ones that we're going to talk about, and that you'll see commonly across everything, is layout. We need to lay things out on screens, and CSS frameworks give us that ability to do that kind of stuff. So layout is one of the big ones. Common design features, things like rounded corners on containers and buttons and stuff like that, gradients, shadows, where we want a box shadow appearing beneath a container. Again, these are common things that we do in terms of a UI, and CSS provides us with styling rules that make it a lot easier for us to do. We just define a rule, and then it just happens. Things like custom fonts, it's another very common feature. It's been around for a while, but it's become much more visible and is much more highly used now in the world of CSS 3. And you can even do some more fancier things like 2D and 3D transitions and animations. So again, that's another really important one that it can do. Now, why should developers care? Because the common argument I get is that, you know, CSS, though, isn't that a designer's job? And not necessarily. I would actually argue against that. To a certain extent, yes. Graphic designers are the people that you want to be doing your graphic design. But at the end of the day, you don't need a graphic designer there from day one. But you want your application to look and feel as close as you can without having that person on board. That's what a lot of us have. We don't have that full-time graphic designer to be there implementing our UIs all the time. So going further with that, we should care as developers, because CSS will take our functional, our logic that we've written, that gives us the meat and the core functionality in our apps, and make it look appealing, which is kind of the important part, right? Like, you really want it to look and feel good to the end user. And like I say, you want to bring it to like the 60 or 70% mark when it comes to your final UI. Now, why is that important? So let's say you're building an application, something like this, like jsbin.com. This is a web application, and what it'll actually do is, you know, you can actually write, it's a little IDE for the web, so you can actually write a little bit of HTML, JavaScript, CSS, compile it, run it, see how it all works, and that's kind of how it all works together. So functionally, there's a lot of functionality going on there, but this is how it looks with everything turned on. Now, if I'm trying to prototype this and demo this to people to get people engaged with the site or the application, and I don't apply CSS, this is what it's going to look like. This looks horrible, right? Like, this is the thing. From a functionality point of view, it's identical. But trying to engage people with a demo using the page I just showed you, or that I'm showing you now, isn't very good. Like, it's a lot of problems. Functionally, they're identical. So this is kind of the point I'm trying to make here, is the fact that you do want to bring it to a certain level to make it look and feel good before you go off and decide that it's just a designer's job. You don't want a designer to step in at one point, but you want to make it look as good as possible so people actually recognize your work and really care about it. So let's talk about the meat here. Let's get into this thing. So what is a CSS framework? We want to talk about that in a little bit here. I also want to kind of address the question about what you should look for when you're picking a CSS framework. There's a lot of different options out there. None of them are, like, they're all good and bad in their own way. It's a matter of picking the one that works best for you and your team. So we're going to talk a bit about that. And how do you use it inside of your product? We're going to see a demo of this, how to integrate this, what you get when you take one of these frameworks and start integrating it into your code, and how that actually works. So let's start this off. So when we talk CSS frameworks, well, what is it? When I think of the word framework, I think of Microsoft.net. Like, I immediately jump to the Microsoft space where I see .NET framework, and you have this big complex set, this complex, you know, library of code. And you got like these crazy diagrams on the right hand side where you have all these different components and they're all layered and they all do this kind of fun stuff. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on inside of there. So we want to talk about, you know, with respect to a CSS framework, is it as complicated as the .NET framework? No, I wouldn't go that way, but they are very similar in a lot of respects. So more specifically, right, it's a set of common tools that you can use to implement inside of your HTML that allow you to deliver a very common styling tasks. So a framework, right, just it provides you with that common functionality so you can configure your HTML to leverage it. So things like layout is a common example. You implement layout across all HTML applications, whether you want to or not, whether it's a Windows app or a Windows Store app, whether it's a website, you need to lay things out on the web pages. And even if they're different applications, you're working on four different apps throughout the next year or whatever, each one of them is going to have layout. And it's going to be likely, although the layout will not be identical from the end user perspective, from a programmatic point of view, you know, implementing that layout, these are the things that are very common. Like, these are the things you're going to want to be able to do. So you're going to be doing the same thing over and over again in terms of implementing that functionality, and that's where our CSS framework can come into play. So what are some other common things? So things like common controls that we're used to, like things like buttons, text boxes, forms, drop-down menus, providing some of those kind of things, typography, headers, dividers, different sort of typography sort of settings, styling your navigation, the way your navigation works inside of your application, whether it's through breadcrumbs or through buttons or through a header or something like that. Navigation is another very common feature that you carry across multiple applications. And one other really more interesting one that's become more popular recently is responsive design. So the ability to take a single code base and actually have that code or that single HTML code base and have it render differently depending on what the size of the device is that you're looking for. So again, very, very powerful stuff in terms of what these frameworks can provide. So, but the big question you gotta ask yourself before you pick one, before you dive right into it, is really what UI features do you need for your project? And you really need to ask yourself that question because there's so many features out there. You need to really think about what you need to leverage. Now, when you think about what features are available, you have a lot of different options, right? There's grids, like a grid-based layout. This is a very common design tactic for laying things out because it's a common way of communicating with your design team as well, right? Laying things out in a grid pattern where you have rows and columns and you just kind of place things inside of these sort of boxes. That is one thing you might be looking for. All right, layout, layout, and more layout because there are so many flavors of layout and there are ways of doing it, and these frameworks can provide that for you. Things like a fluid layout that as you adjust there, it's more of a re your elements inside of your HTML code are relative to the size of the screen. So as someone resizes it, it goes off and makes a change. A fixed layout where, again, based on the size of the screen, it can also have a certain pixel width, but it won't adjust between a certain ratio. So you'll have like everything is always 960 pixels or something like that. So a fixed sort of layout. At the end of the day, responsive layout, again, like we were saying, one code base, multiple displays and devices. Being able to handle applying different CSS rules and tweaking that UI just right so that when people look at it on a smaller device, it still looks good. Another common UI feature that a lot of people like is a common look and feel. This is something that gets overlooked a lot of the time where we can actually forget that we need these buttons and we want a button to look like a button all the time and we want to make sure that it's easy for people to notice this and when they know how to use it on our site or our app, that they constantly recognize this. So having a common look and feel across common controls, text boxes and buttons and so forth, is a very, very important feature to have as well. Now, at the end of the day though, what we're really trying to boil down here is that you want an application that looks as good as the functionality it provides. So sometimes it's not just a matter of the functionality from the layout or from providing a common look and feel on these controls, but rather you want that application to look as good as the functionality you've built. It has to look good so that the end users can digest it a little bit easier and not focus on how horrible it looks, And there's always that great saying of designed by developers. Pardon me. Designed by developers where, it just looks like it just looks kind of like a mess on screen. And we don't want any of that. We want people to have a positive outlook on our application because once they have if it looks good, then they're gonna come into it with an optimistic viewpoint and they can actually start digesting that functionality we've worked so hard to get out there to them. Some examples of CSS frameworks. The most common one that I've seen and that I work with is Twitter Bootstrap. So Twitter Bootstrap is again, these are is a very common one. It gives a kind of a common look and feel to the twitter.com site. There's also the 960 grid system where we were talking about grids earlier in terms of a layout. So having a common grid system is again very, very popular way of doing things. Blueprint CSS provides again another series of layout features and along with a couple things regarding common look and feel. The YAML CSS framework from Yahoo. Yahoo has done some great work with regard to HTML5 and really pushing it forward. And the YAML CSS framework is a really, really cool one. There are many, many more to look at. If you want to see some more examples, go to the Wikipedia site, wikipedia.org's CSS frameworks. Take a look for that and take a look at some of the different options. So what should you look for though when you're picking one of these out? So we talked about the features that you're going to want. All of these frameworks provide their own set of their own flavor of the very common features. But what should you personally look for your project? And it really depends, right? I mean, at the end of the day, you're looking at a lot of different things. Like, you can look at the team that you have to work with. Some of us have a full-time graphic designer on hand, and that's a great person to have on your team. So maybe it's a little bit less important to have a lot of that common look and feel out-of-the-box styling-wise with your CSS or with your CSS framework. That applies the same thing with the resources available. Maybe you do have a graphic designer, but they're not available to a point where they can actually write you a whole set of themes for things like buttons and hovers and all this kind of stuff. Priorities within your design. Maybe design isn't the most important. Maybe you end up doing something simple like a command line app. There's still CSS that could be applied to that. But again, maybe it's not as important to have this really rich look and feel. The complexity of the design you're trying to implement. You know, you want it to, if you're having a low-end design complexity, maybe you just need something basic for layout, or maybe you just need it just for the button aspect. At the end of the day, maybe it's the state of your project. Maybe you've gone so far down a certain design path, you can only kind of implement certain things, certain specific features. You know, you want to kind of look at all of these different factors from a UI point of view and from a project point of view, and you want to make sure when you're looking at what framework to pick, you treat it no different than any external library you would choose to include in your software. That's kind of one of the key things. And even though it's just a lot of people say, oh, it's just a CSS framework, this is one of those things that you want to pick the right one to do the right job. You wouldn't include a bad library in your app just because it did one thing. Like, it was just kind of a horrible library. This is the same thing. You don't want to include something that is going to add a lot of overhead, a lot of mess to your project if it's not going to work for your team. Okay? So today we're going to be focusing in on Twitter Bootstrap for our demos. Now you can go to twitter.github.com/bootstrap. And actually, when you go there, that is actually a Twitter Bootstrap themed site. And it will actually, you can browse through the site and see all the different features you get inside of there. Now, inside of this CSS framework. Today I'm not going to be going through all the details of Bootstrap and what functionality it provides and what features. But rather, I want to kind of show you how you can leverage this inside of your application and what you get when you roll it into your app. Okay, but I strongly suggest you check this one out, and it's a full open source project. You can actually see the source code if you're looking for the inner workings of it. But yeah, definitely take a look. So let's do a demo here for using Bootstrap. Now, personally, I am using WebMatrix for my IDE. Oh, 1 second here, I just gotta fix my mouse. Try this again. There we go. So I'm using WebMatrix. Now, although we've been talking about Windows Store apps for a lot of the day, we want to make sure that we understand, like, again, HTML5 is really cool in the way that it can apply to not just web applications, but store apps or any other desktop app too. It's become more and more common. So how you leverage this inside of your web application is no different than how you would leverage it inside of a Windows Store app. Just it might be what features you end up leveraging might be a bit different. So what I've done is I've downloaded Bootstrap from the GitHub project site, and I've just included a Bootstrap folder inside of my application. So if I actually zoom in here a little bit, you can see I have a Bootstrap folder, and inside there I got a CSS folder, an images folder, and a JS folder. Inside each of these, I'm going to kind of walk you through what each file is. And this is a very common thing you're going to see across multiple frameworks. So I want to kind of make sure you're familiar with what you're getting here. So what you get for CSS, you actually get a minified version of bootstrap.css as well as the original, along with responsive.css and its minified version. So bootstrap.css is the bulk of Twitter Bootstrap. It's the CSS framework. It contains all your layouts and all your different kind of elements that you really care about in terms of just out-of-the-box, cool functionality and styling. So a lot of if you just include that one file, you've got a lot of functionality there. If you want to get a step further, you want that responsive design aspect to some of those features we were talking about before. We have they have the Bootstrap responsive CSS. Now that's going to actually help me adjust my CSS in Twitter Bootstrap depending on what screen size. So again, this is probably a little bit more of a web-specific feature rather than a Windows Store. But if I'm leveraging multiple devices and maybe I'm leveraging a native application in Windows Store, it can actually write CSS for that specific case. It'll apply specific rules based on the device size. Pardon me. So with that, I also have my images folder. Now there's nothing much in here. Just two glyph icons, half-linked files, One are black icons, one are white. Now, this is actually a feature inside of Twitter Bootstrap that gives me a set of common icons that I can use across my applications. So again, we might be looking to get my design, our designers, to write us a set of custom icons that make us that are a little bit more branded to our app. But things like opening files and getting the bulk of that functionality going up front, you know, it's better to have a little icon if you're going to have an icon rather than just a big word that says open. You want to try to bring it to that point where it gives it that final look and feel. Bring it to 60 or 70%. These icons can really help with that. Inside of the JS file, you guessed it, we have JavaScript. Now, even though it's a CSS framework, Twitter Bootstrap does leverage some JavaScript for some of the richer features. They have things like a sort of a slide deck control that allows your carousel that slides images back and forth. And there's a bunch of different things like that that they actually provide, like collapsible navigation components and different things. These features are not required to run Twitter Bootstrap, but it can provide a really rich experience, and that's what the JavaScript comes in. So when you're looking through the Twitter Bootstrap site on GitHub, it'll actually denote what specific features require the JavaScript and require the responsive aspect responsive CSS file, because technically you don't need all that to run Bootstrap, but rather if you want some of the richer, more engaging, some of the richer features that kind of come with it, you will have to include these. And if you're looking for a high level of performance, you might want to make sure that you want to minimize the number of the number of files you actually include. Pardon me. Okay. So that's what you get out of the box. And all I've done here is I've included it in my web app, my website. So I've just included a Bootstrap file. And then the next step to get this thing going is to actually include the files. So you can see here I've linked the two CSS files, the bootstrap.css and the responsive one. I've also included the JS file. Now that applies the CSS framework to my app, but that does not necessarily mean my app looks like anything. It looks like anything special. So I just kind of did a little, so you can see here, my HTML is just really basic navigation. So if I run this app, I'm gonna run an Internet Explorer here. You can see here that I have my navigation. Now this is not a fancy application by any stretch of the imagination. Don't get me wrong, I have no illusions of that. But I know that I want my navigation to look a little bit better than this. Maybe I'm in charge of that. So how do I do that? Now Twitter Bootstrap has a number of ways of doing navigation, and I'm going to leverage one of those. I'm going to use what they call a nav bar. Now, the way I implement that is just like I would apply any other CSS. So I just kind of injected all my classes, and you can see here, I've set my header to have a nav bar class, and then I have this nav bar fixed up because this is one of the features that come with Bootstrap that I can actually fix the nav bar to the top of the screen. And then I have a container that is a fluid container, so I want to make sure that my UI is a fluid one, not a fixed layout. And then I go down to the details here about I have nav pills, a certain styling aspect, and I have to find my nav, and so on and so forth. So when I actually look at this, I do a refresh. Oh, I gotta save the file. That might be important. Now you can see my navigation has changed quite a bit, but it is the exact same HTML code. I just applied the CSS framework. So one really interesting way, a different way of looking at a CSS framework is again, it's a series of built-in CSS classes and tools that I can leverage pardon me, inside of my HTML to maximize my look and feel. So again, this kind of looks and feels a lot like a Twitter layout. Do I want it to be that way? Maybe not. For my release, but at least I can get to the point to understand how this app is going to look and feel, and it gives me that right out of the box with very minimal effort on my part. Now, again, there's a lot of different features we can go into and start playing with. I'm not going to go into those today. Rather, I strongly suggest you go to the Twitter Bootstrap site and start exploring those features and seeing which ones could make most sense for you. So there's that. There's a Twitter Bootstrap. So again, it's twitter.github.com/bootstrap. Definitely check it out. Very, very powerful. And again, you can see kind of all the things. You can even customize your downloads, so you only have to get the things you want for your app that you're going to leverage inside of your application. So if you go a little bit further than that, if you're a Visual Studio person, You don't have to do it manually like we did before, where you actually drop the folder in there. Rather, you can use something like NuGet, and you can actually do twitter.bootstrap from inside NuGet, and then you can continually update your NuGet packages. It just does the exact same thing we just did. Just installs a bootstrap file, and it just kind of injects it in the right spots. Pardon me. But that aside, you don't have to worry about keeping up to date on what packages or when Twitter Bootstrap is updated, and actually going in manually doing those updates. So this will NuGet will notify you. So Twitter Bootstrap is actually fairly actively developed. They just did another release, version 2.3, in the middle of February, and they updated the NuGet gallery really quickly on that one too. So it's again another way of doing it. There are other ways of doing or implementing Twitter Bootstrap throughout whatever flavor of framework you're looking at, whether it's Microsoft-based or Ruby or whatever. There are a lot of different ways you can leverage Twitter Bootstrap. Just know that this is a very common one, and it is a very powerful feature, but it's understanding that once you install it, if you want to leverage some of those, what features you want to leverage inside, whether it's layout or just some of the buttons or some of the more richer UI tools that come with the JavaScript side of things. So now we've talked about frameworks. Now, what was great about frameworks, we made our app look really good really quickly. So we took a lot of that design aspect out of it, in terms of, you know, worrying about getting a graphic designer to make it look good. So when we say designed by developers, you can use Twitter Bootstrap, and that is designed by developers. It'll look really good. But what about I got to write my own CSS? That's where compilers come into play. Now, writing CSS has never been the easiest thing in the world for developers, but a compiler, the CSS compilers that we're going to show you today, really kind of demonstrate how CSS can be a developer tool as well, not just a designer's tool. So what do you get when we're talking about a CSS compiler? Well, a CSS compiler, at the end of the day, when you're talking about what it is, it's a tool that makes managing your CSS easier. And it does this by providing a richer language syntax. So CSS has been around for quite a while now, and it's one of those things that I, as a developer that's been working on it for a long time, I still find it somewhat challenging to manage these large files, because it's so different than regular software development. And a CSS compiler can provide you more language features to make it feel a little bit more natural, a little bit more comfortable, and ultimately easier to manage your code. It also allows the compiler tool itself, not just the language, but the compiler will actually minify and validate our CSS to make sure that every time we write our code, it actually produces a nice, clean CSS file that is minified, that is validated against CSS lint, as compressed. You know, these are things that we don't necessarily want to have to worry about, but a compiler will just take care of all of that underneath the covers for us and make it a lot easier for developers to just write the code that they need to do to implement those complex designs. So there's two major examples out there in the world right now. We're talking about Less today, for the most part, which is a dynamic style sheet language, and we're going to talk about that in a bit. But there's also SAS, which is syntactically awesome style sheets. So SAS is actually more Ruby friendly, the way I would word it. You can install it by using a Ruby gem. You set it up, and you're ready to go, and you can start compiling and doing all your kind of fun stuff right away. Less is very similar in that regard. It works in a very similar way, except the reason I've picked this one today is that I'm more of a Node.js person, and it really allows me to run Less on my server and compile it using Node. So that's really what I'm trying to do. Less also provides a client-side version of the compiler. So if you have a modern browser like IE10 or IE9, it'll actually allow you to not have to worry about the compilation on your end at all. Rather, the client will actually compile your Less files for you. So again, it's just a different way. You're just shifting over that compilation responsibility to the client. I'm more of a server-friendly person. I like using the server. We're going to talk about it from the low level, but how we're going to use this from the command line, how we're going to use Less from the command line to compile down our Less files into really nice, easy to use CSS files. But before we do that, I want to kind of talk about some of the common features you get with a CSS compiler. So not only does it do the things like minifying and provide some richer syntax, some of the features that you get out of it, like some of the language features that you get in a compiler language, a CSS compiler language versus just regular CSS, something like, are things like variables. Now, from a developer point of view, this, I thought, was one of the more powerful features that comes with a CSS compiler, because when I have a large amount of CSS and things like colors or font changes or anything like that happened, it's a pain to have to go through all of my files to make sure that that one variable gets changed, or that one styling rule, or the styling rules that apply that color get changed all at the same time. Now, I can actually define a variable section, or whatever you want to call it. So I define all my variables up front, set those property values, or set those values, and then apply them throughout my CSS wherever I want to use them. So again, very, very powerful feature to have variables. And then adjust them whenever the designer comes back and makes that, you know, want to go from magenta to slightly different magenta or something like that. We also get things called mixins. So a mixin is a CSS rule that you can mix in with other CSS rules. It's very clever. You can think of them from a developer point of view as a as a function or a method. So a reusable CSS rule. So if I am writing if I have written a rule and I've encapsulated a bunch of specialized kind of, let's say, a background gradient code, I can actually reuse that same set of rules in another rule somewhere else. And we're going to see that in a little bit. To take it even further, because we have variables, you can actually have parameterized mixins as well. So I can not only just reuse the rule, but I can pass parameters to that rule to adjust it just for that need. So it's, again, very, very powerful. From a syntax point of view, nested rules are, again, very, very cool, where I can actually have a button rule and then define a rule inside of that one that will have scope to it. So whatever rule, whatever variables I define inside of a rule, I can define other rules that can leverage that. So I kind of have this whole layer of scope to go with it. So again, another very powerful feature. A lot of the CSS frameworks we're talking, or CSS compilers we're talking about too, provides within a bunch of functions and operations as well. So things that are very common, like things like changing the opacity of an element or anything like that. So you can apply these CSS functions and just say, hey, these are the things that I know I want. I want 20% less opacity or more. I want to fade in or fade out or whatever. Again, these are common things that you want to do, and they provide you with a whole library of them. And if you go through whatever your flavor is of CSS compiler, there's a whole lot of them, and I strongly suggest you go through them and see what you actually have available to you. Now, my second favorite feature outside of variables is the ampersand that shows up in both these in the CSS compilers, which is actually a language feature that allows us to use this, or the this keyword from regular language like JavaScript. So if I define a rule, instead of having to define a series of selectors and then nest those selectors properly, I can actually just use ampersand to write a nested rule about whatever rule I'm talking about. I'll demonstrate this in a little bit, but this allows you to kind of leverage the this element, or the this keyword, from within CSS for your specific selector. So let's go into using some less and actually see this thing in action. So again, I'm going to use WebMatrix to demonstrate this code here. So I'm going to go into my CSS. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to walk you through a less file. And at the same time, we're going to define different variables, and we're going to define some of these things, and we're going to kind of walk through how this all works, and then we're going to start using the command line compiler. So what you can see here is I have a style.less. So the end file, the file extension is a .less file. And in here, I'm using, in WebMatrix, I'm using the Orange Bits compiler, which actually gives me some IntelliSense and some syntax highlighting. You can get the same sort of thing using the Web Essentials plugin for Visual Studio, and there are other countless number of ways of leveraging the less or sass syntax highlighting and stuff like that. There's a bunch of tools for that out there for all the popular platforms. I generally live inside of the Node.js, and I live inside of Visual Studio, so for me this kind of works best for me. So pardon me. See here, I have my spacer variable. And my spacer variable here is just, it's very clear. I put an @ sign, and although I get my CSS kind of my rules here, what I can do is I can actually say, like, my variable, And then I do a colon, and then I define the value. So I can say 12 pixels. I could also do something like, I can define a color. So I'll do 100. Pardon me. You can store whatever sort of CSS data you want inside of a variable and then apply it later on. So for example, since I have my background color here, if I wanted to find a new rule, I have to find, just like I would a regular CSS rule, so like my awesome rule, and then I can actually do, let's do background color, and I'm going to use my variable. Now you can see because I'm using my plugin, I get my IntelliSense as well. So I'm just going to leverage that, and voila, I actually have my, I'm using my variable. Now one thing you might have noticed here is that even though I'm using a less file, this all actually looks a lot like regular CSS, and it is. Less is actually almost like a superset of CSS. It basically extends the CSS rules, language rules, to kind of get some of these extra features. So I just find a regular CSS rule, but it's the same way I would define something like a mixin. So if this is actually right out of the box, is already a mixin, which is one of those reusable components of code. Now, if I wanted to actually add variables to this, I just actually open some brackets and then I define a variable. So I do param one, and I can actually define a default value. So let's say I'm going to be doing something with a width or some padding. So now I go in here and I do padding, and I'm going to use param. There we go, padding, we'll just do, and then I'm going to do, oh, I need to do @ param one. Nope, pardon me, there we go. And now you can see here, I'm leveraging that. And again, there's scope to this, because if I actually go out here, and I try to leverage that, so if I do dot, we do dot my other rule, and I do, let's say, padding. You can see here in my IntelliSense, if I zoom in a little bit for everyone, scroll down, you can see I actually don't have access to that anymore, that param one. Because again, that's the scope aspect that kind of comes with less. I can define stuff like that. So I'm actually going to delete my other rule because I don't really need that. I was just going to try to demonstrate that. to kind of keep it going further, to kind of show you some of the real power inside that you can get with these sort of things like mixins, if you go to lesselements.com, it provides you with it's an open source library of a number of different less mixins and features that are all implemented inside of just regular less, but they're, again, they're reusable. So it's almost like a combination of a compiler mixing with your frameworks. So again, one of the ones I pulled from the open source library there is a background gradient mixin. So this code is how you would write a background gradient to work in cross-browser. So for those of you that are not familiar with worrying about multiple browsers, with HTML5, there's always been this contention of, you know, there's vendor prefixes and all these kind of rules about how, you know, a gradient will work inside of WebKit versus how it'll be defined inside of Mozilla versus whatever. So although as they progress, the prefixes become less and less important, but certain versions of the browser require that. So to properly define for all browsers, you want to make sure you kind of have the statement, the linear gradient statement set up multiple times. So this is a lot of code. If you wanted to have a gradient carried over to a lot of different functions, this is a lot of work for a background gradient. It's 6 lines of code to make it work for everything. So what they've done here is they defined a background gradient mixin that I can leverage in other spots. So I can actually define the color that I'm going to use along with the starting point and the stopping point of the gradient. So I want to leverage this, go into my page content here. I can actually leverage that by just push enter, and I do dot, and you can see here, if I zoom in again, I have my awesome rule, which is the one I actually defined earlier, and then I have my background gradient, which is the one that is very powerful from the lesselements.com. So all I do, we'll just do background gradient, and then that's it. Now if I want to provide, now this is going to provide, if I just let it sit like this, that's going to work just fine. That's going to use the default values that were actually defined in the parameter up here, or in the parameters up top here. But if I want to change them for myself, I can go off and set my variable to be, you know, again, my color variable that I'd set before. And I can set stop, starting and stop, but I'm just going to kind of pick the regular ones. So again, that is how easy it is to reuse. And you can see how much cleaner this is so that I can actually see this kind of thing working in action here. And I mean, it just makes, I don't have to repeat all of this code. So I keep scrolling down. Another good example of actually defined yet another background color, another variable, a scoped variable inside of my page content, and I applied what they call the grayscale function that comes with less. So this is actually going to take a grayscale tone to my background, so if I want to kind of adjust it. And I'm also going to take that color. You can see when I set my background property, my background color property, I'm actually doing a fade in. I want it to be a little bit more visible. So I have it sit up here to a alpha of 0.5, so 50%. I want to fade that in by 40%. Now, these themes, these might seem a little bit weird to a lot of like developers, because like, why would we be, we'd be adjusting these kind of functions? I have found them very useful when you're doing a lot of debugging, you're trying to adjust that site just to get it right when you don't have the graphic designer on board just yet. So sometimes this kind of stuff is really, really powerful in that regard, and creating the right classes just to get that right effect of how transparent the item should be and stuff like that. So that's that one there. If I scroll down to the bottom here, and see, I have to find a rule for my button. So for my button, though, I actually want to define a second rule for it, more specifically a hover rule. Now, this is where I'm going to use my this variable, my ampersand. So I do actually do that, and I can do define a nested rule. So what this is doing here is the ampersand is using the parent selector that it's nested inside of. So it's using this. So this hover. So I can just find a hover for this, and I'm going to do padding is equal to, let's say, 100 pixels. We'll see how that works. So whenever I hover, my padding should dramatically increase. But actually, let's actually change that a little bit more to be, we'll just keep it like that. Anyway, what we're going to do now is we've got our CSS file written, our less file written. Now we need to turn it into CSS. So how do we do that? Well, taking the liberty of going into my command line, all you do is you want to install the Less compiler. You want to install Less because I'm using Node.js, so I have a Node.js machine set up here. So I'm going to be using the npm. So I do npm install Less, and this does its thing. Npm, for those of you that are not familiar with it, it's a lot like Ruby Gems or NuGet. It's a package manager for Node. And I'm just leveraging it to install less on that. So now I'm ready to go. Now I'm sitting inside of my styles folder, inside of my site. So if I want to compile, I do less C is my keyword. And I'm going to do less C style.less. And now what you can see here, if you can look, what you're seeing here is it's actually outputted all of the compiled CSS right to standard out, which, yes, isn't very useful right now because we're not going to really use the standard out. But I just wanted to kind of demonstrate that it just does the compilation there. So you can see here, if I scroll down to the bottom, you have my button rule right here. So I have my first button rule that injects the background gradient mixin that we defined earlier, and then here on button.hover, or a button hover state, you actually get the padding of 100 pixels. So you can see how much more complicated this looks, right, compared to what we wrote, which is a lot more simplistic in terms of the way how it's organized. So I'm going to zoom out a bit so you actually can see it. It's a lot less code, a lot easier to manage and identify. So if I want to go off and, so I'm going to take this, I want to write my CSS file. I just do less C, style.less, and then I do output to style.css. So I'm going to open that file up, and you can see here it's the exact same thing we were getting with our, I'm going to zoom in a little bit so we can see, but it's the exact same thing we had when we were talking about, when we saw it in the standard out. So again, very, very easy to use, very easy, very, very, very simplified to actually get this thing to work. So what if I want to compress it though? What if I want to take it to the next level and actually get it boiled down? Well, that's where we can actually, again, it's just a command inside of our inside of our compiler, where I use the the minify property, and I actually didn't output that to a proper file though. So I minified to the standard out, but I'm going to minify it to style.css, and I go back here. I'm going to reload it, and then you can see here I have everything on three lines. It's a lot less code than we had before. If I want to take it even a step further, I can use the YUI compressor, which comes with less, and actually we'll boil it down to one. So depending on what level of performance you're looking for, this is what you can kind of get out of the deal. And it's again, very, very easy to use. And since one reason I like kind of pointing out that we're using the command line is that because I'm using a command prompt here, I can leverage this from inside of regular scripts or anything like that. So I can script this up pretty easily and actually use my compiler. Now, if that's not an option for you to compile on the server like I am doing right now, there are other options like the less.js library that you can include on the client that will actually let the client application compile your less files. So again, there are multiple ways of doing all of these things. But again, for us, the server is actually pretty good. And I mean, generally, you can hopefully leverage it inside of a script of some kind. So the last thing I wanted to demonstrate with less and the CSS compilers is the idea that, okay, so I have one file so far. Now, what if you look at something like Twitter Bootstrap, like a CSS framework, they have a countless numbers of files to keep it all organized. You know, you want your button styling code to be in one spot, you want your layout code to be in another spot, you want your fixed layout code to be in another spot. When I'm writing CSS for my application, I want to make sure that it's easily organized and make it accessible to my development team so that they know where everything lives and not have this one file that is, you know, 9,000 lines of code. So one way of doing that, so I go back to my style.less file here. I'm going to scroll up to the top and zoom in a bit. Zoom in on the font. Now, a very common thing to do, and this works in regular CSS, is to use an import statement. Now, an import statement will allow you to actually reference other CSS files, and it'll actually download them on the site. So once the browser loads my source CSS file, the import statements will then download the corresponding extra ones and then apply all the rules together. So you'll have all that CSS together. The problem with that, from a web perspective at the very least, is the fact that you're making multiple requests now. So from a performance standpoint, that's not really the best way of doing it. Now, when you're talking about less, though, it uses the same import statement, but it's actually not going to, we don't have to worry about anything like that, because what we're going to do is do an import of morestyle.less. So if I look at my morestyle.less file, it's actually just a simple variable. It's just called the superspacer variable, and you can define whatever you want in here. So you can do, you know, my other rule, and then we do padding is equal to superspacer or whatever. Now, what you're going to get with this too is that when I go to my style.less, it's going to import all that into one single file and output the right thing and output everything compressed together. So again, if I go to my command line and I redo it here, I'm just going to do into style.less. I'm going to reload the file. Here you can see my other rule has been brought in, and I use my superspacer variable, and you can even make that reference from inside your source file. So if I wanted to go off and say, apply a padding rule of superspacer to my button, again, I'm gonna recompile here. And I'm gonna go to my style that, so I, again, still have my other rule. Scroll down to the bottom here. Now you can see I have my padding rule has been applied. So this makes it a lot easier for me to actually manage multiple files for my CSS to keep it all organized, but still getting the performance I want, whether I'm using CSS for a store app or whether I'm using it for a web application. Either one kind of works. So again, Again, I'm doing it all from the command line, so I can again use this from inside of a build script or anything like that, and do it on demand. But I could still do it technically over the wire or on the client side using the less.js client side library. But I would recommend the server side one. A lot of different ways to use it, though. Okay, so with that, let's go back to the slide deck here. So that kind of wraps up what I wanted to cover today with CSS frameworks. So what we've talked about so far today is we've gone over some of the goals we had for today were to talk about CSS frameworks and compilers. So specifically, the new features that you can get out of them, how to use them specifically. So we saw how to include Twitter Bootstrap or any of those other ones into a web application, which is the same way we do for a store application. And we also know how to use a compiler through the command line, or we can use less.js on the client side if we really want. We also now also understand, hopefully a little bit better, what they actually are. I find that that gets lost in translation a bunch about when you're talking about a CSS framework, you think about something bigger like the .NET framework when it's really they're similar in what they provide in terms of functionality, but they are very different at the end of the day where they aren't actually they're just providing a series of CSS classes for you to leverage. I also want to teach one or more ways you can apply design to your project, which ultimately just hopefully remove some of the fear from design from developers. Again, if we're lucky enough to have a full-time graphics person on our team that's doing nothing but implementing UI code, that's great. A lot of the cases I've ever worked in and what people generally see is not necessarily that. So if you can bring your site UI to a 60 or 70% level with a framework and then make that code easier to manage by leveraging a CSS compiler, you can really kind of make your you can really be you can turn a developer into a designer, technically, you know. Not gonna bring it, it's not gonna you're not gonna be doing, you know, fancy designs in Photoshop anytime soon, but at least you can make your apps look good from day one. So that way your end users that are your test users can at least focus in on seeing how your app works rather than getting caught up in how it looks. So that was our agenda for the day. We covered an introduction, we did warming up the CSS and frameworks and compilers. So my name is David West. Pardon me. You can catch me on Twitter at David West. You can also go to my website at davidwest.com. You can email me directly at dw@davidwest.com if you'd like, with any questions you might have. Also, feel free to check out some of my projects. I got zanyvideogamequotes.com going on, which is an HTML site we're constantly trying to update and bring into the modern world. It's a 15-year-old site, so definitely check it out. You can like us on Facebook as well. And also check out my other video game that I produced. That's HTML5 video game at brewpubgames.com/lovebucket. So check it out, play the game, let us know what you think, or like us on Facebook and check it out and start a discussion there. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Jonathan and the team, and that'll be that. So thank you very much.